I'm Mark Franklin, practice leader of a team of professional career counselors at CareerCycles.com and founder of One Life Tools. I'm pleased to be your host today on Career Buzz, Canada's unique podcast conversation that enriches lives, empowers careers, and energizes organizations. Today, I'm your Career Buzz correspondent, interviewing keynoters and speakers on site at the Canadian Positive Psychology Association's 2018 conference here in Toronto. The CPPA promotes the science and practice of positive psychology and builds collaboration among researchers, practitioners, teachers, and students across Canada. Up first, Dr. Ryan Nemec is Education Director at the VIA Institute on Character. It's a global nonprofit organization in Cincinnati, Ohio, that advances the latest science and practical applications of character strengths. He's an award-winning psychologist, adjunct professor at Xavier University, and instructor at the University of Pennsylvania. He is passionate about the connection between character strengths and mindfulness, spirituality, health, disability, parenting, positive movies, and savoring. Ryan Nemec is author of several books, including Character Strengths Interventions, Mindfulness and Character Strengths, and Positive Psychology at the Movies. Just tell us, what are you doing right now in your career?
Well, I'm the education director of the VIA Institute on Character, so my job is really to try to understand these core qualities that are in all human beings. So these strengths like curiosity, love, gratitude, kindness, and there's 24 core qualities that are in all human beings across countries, cultures, beliefs. And my job is to really understand how these strengths play out in our daily life and how we can use them more.
Nice. And what are one or two things that you really like about your job?
Well, I love that it really taps into one of my core character strengths of hope. In that when I work with these character strengths, I'm filled with this sense of hope for the future, for society. So whenever I start to kind of get down, like, this isn't going right politically, or this isn't going right with this particular group, I remember that there's these core qualities that are in everybody that we can turn to and that I can encourage in them. And that really fills me with a sense of optimism for the future, for people.
Nice. So I usually ask that question, what strengths do you use in your job to be successful? You've now just named one of hope. What else? What are a couple of other, whether they're character strengths or other skills that you draw on regularly to be successful?
Absolutely. So one for sure is another top strength of mind of love. And a lot of people might think, well, how do you bring love into the workplace? That's more just for your romantic or intimate relationships. But really, the strength of love cuts across all the domains of our life. And so for me, it's bringing conveying a sense of warmth and genuineness and being a good listener, really being there for my colleagues, being there for new people that I meet, and really connecting in that way. It's all about connecting. And then one more example is curiosity. And this is kind of an interesting strength. And again, all of us have it. And, you know, because I'm high in curiosity, I'm able to quickly tap into a questioning approach with somebody or an exploratory approach. And you can too, Mark. I know that you're very high in curiosity. So, yeah, and I'm able to do that as I'm meeting new researchers or meeting new people at this store, at this business, or at this school, or I'm meeting new practitioners, coaches out there. It helps me to connect with them by exploring with them and looking for something new with them. So
nice.
It's useful.
Yeah. What's one turning point that you can share with listeners? You weren't always the education director at VIA Institute. So what's one turning point that eventually brought you to this point in your career?
Yeah, so a turning point for me would be when my wife and I decided to move from St. Louis, where I was doing, everything was going quite well professionally, but we decided when we really took a good hard look at ourselves, we wanted to be closer to our families. And my family is in the state of Michigan, my wife's family is in Kentucky. So we decided to move to sort of a middle ground point. And so we kind of left our, you know, good careers in St. Louis to come to St. Louis to be, or to come to Cincinnati to be closer to our families. And that was a big change. It actually ended up leading, you know, kind of being driven by that that sense of love for family and connectedness, that ended up leading to dream jobs, quite literally, for my wife, who's a child psychologist at the Cincinnati Children's Hospital, and for me as education director.
Wow, so you moved first and then the dream jobs came?
Exactly.
Wow, it usually goes in the opposite order.
I know. It was a lot of synchronicity there that made that happen. It was pretty amazing.
Let's just start with this idea of using your strengths, optimal use of strengths, and then this question of overusing or underusing. Most people think like, oh, I've got a strength, I should just really use that a lot, and yet we can overplay it or overuse it, and I found that was fascinating. What can you share with listeners about that optimal use and how to avoid over and underusing?
Sure. So we can overuse, overplay any of our best qualities. So we can actually have too much of a good thing. So when we think of curiosity or creativity or leadership or teamwork or gratitude, we can bring forth too much in this, and that then impacts the relationship in some way, or it impacts us. So somebody might overplay their perseverance strength. They're going and going and going and working so hard and trying. They have their eye on this particular outcome for this particular project. And the people around them are saying, this project is done. It's just not going to work out. You've got to be able to let it go. But the person with perseverance is just kind of not stopping. And so in that situation, it's affecting their health. It's affecting their family relationship. So they might be in that situation, not all the time, but in that situation, overplaying that particular strength. And then that person or a different person could underplay their perseverance. Maybe they're not pursuing a particular relationship strong enough, or they're not sticking with one of their health habits quite strong enough. Maybe they have high cholesterol, or maybe they have high blood pressure and not persevering with the regimen. So they're underusing that same core quality. So we can look at any of these 24 universal character strengths in that way of finding an optimal strengths use or the strength zone for any of them. So an optimal use of in this case, perseverance will be somebody that is working hard, but also is keeping their eye on that wider perspective of not too much and not too little.
I once heard somebody you mentioned in your talk, Robert Biswas-Diener, and he was talking about using your strengths at an 8 out of 10 level, yeah. Which was an eye-opener for me because I thought I should be using it at a 10 out of 10 level, but you should dial it down, like for that perseverance example. What do you have to say about the 8 out of 10 idea for using your strengths?
Yeah, well, absolutely. I mean, it might not always be 8. Like in like one situation, it might be 8. Another situation, it might be a 3. Or another situation, it might be a 4. So, you know, that's the interesting thing is it does change in each context. Maybe if we're persevering in an argument with our spouse, that might just continue to add to more conflict. So maybe we use our perseverance at a 3 with our significant other, and maybe it's at about an 8 in on this particular work project, or a 7 with this one. So each situation kind of brings us to self-reflect a little bit more of what is the best use of the strength in this situation. And a key point in all of this, getting feedback from other people. So what are other people saying about our character strengths use? And do other people perceive that we're overusing or underusing? And so we kind of got to be humble enough to hear what other people have to say about us.
So context sensitivity around the use of strength.
Definitely.
Now, there was another thing you talked about, using your 4 signature strengths at work. And you know, we've heard this word, you know, is work work? Is it a job? Is it a career? Is it a calling? Mm. And there's something that links using strengths to this idea of calling. Now, what is that link?
Yeah, so that study you're referencing was a study in which researchers looked at groups of people, and they looked at how many signature strengths seem to be important for having more positive work experiences and for having work as a calling. And work as a calling meaning work that's actually quite meaningful. It's actually like an extension of who you are. You were just kind of meant to do it. It's just part of you. So what these researchers found is that there seemed to be sort of a cutoff at the use of 4, at least 4, of your best qualities. So at least 4 of your signature strengths. And those people that did that ended up having more positive work experiences and more likely to have say that their work is a calling. Versus people that only use maybe 1 of their signature strengths, they're not bringing forth really that many. So this tells us we want to bring a lot of ourselves to to really our work situation and to our position, not just a little bit
and,
of ourselves.
And if listeners want to, as I did last night, because I went home from your talk and I tried to use those exercises right away. And if listeners are saying, well, wait a second, what are my four character strengths and therefore what would be a calling? I know that I found them just on your website. If people want to find those lists, just to kind of scan them quickly, where do they find that?
Yeah, so if you go to www.viacharacter.org, so that's via character.org, and yeah, you can go to the character strengths tab, and then you can see a number of different looks at it, some with pictures, some that are friendly for children, some that are icons, some that are just text driven and words, so all sorts of looks at those 24 strengths and how to define them. And then on that same place, under the VIA survey tab, VIA, VIA survey tab, people can then take a scientifically valid measure and assess their character strengths from 1 to 24. And so then you would look at, you know, what are your top 5, top 7. Now, you're going to be tempted to look at your bottom 5. That's what everybody wants to do, and there's nothing wrong with that. But just be sure that you look at your top 5 and try to boost those signature strengths.
Right on. So, Ryan, I know there was another study on career counseling and careers related to signature strengths. What was that all about?
Yeah, so this was a study done in Israel that compared traditional career counseling with character strengths-based career counseling. So 4 sessions of the traditional counseling and 4 sessions of character strengths-based career counseling. And so, first of all, let me say what they found. What they found is that those that took a character strengths career counseling approach had greater employment within 6 months afterward, a much higher percentage. I think it was like 80% of the people end up having a job because of that approach, whereas it was much smaller number for the traditional career counseling. And so the character strengths-based career counseling approach was really taking the approach of helping each individual to identify their signature strengths, find ways to use them more in their life, and then link them with their interests. So link them with their career interests. Like what kind of topic are you interested in? What kind of job are you interested in? How might you use your signature strengths? Whatever they are, it doesn't matter which one. So this isn't a direct match like, you know, you're high-end judgment critical thinking, so you should be a lawyer. You know, that's not at all what I'm saying. Instead, it's like, what is your highest strengths? And then whatever you're interested in, let's link those two together. And so that helped people, the clients in this particular project, in this particular study, to really feel much more authentic and that they were searching for work that was much more aligned with who they are. And then, of course, we're talking about calling again, you know, more meaningful work in the future for them.
Right on. Now, just to bring it back to the personal, Ryan, as a last question, we talked a bit about your career and what you like about it and some turning points. From what you've learned from all the work that you've studied on strengths and also your own personal journey, what can you share with listeners about one thing that might help them in their journeys to make good career and life choices? Mm.
So much of this with the character strengths work comes down to both being and doing, and that it's so important for us to try to be our strengths, so to express those core characteristics, that we just be those strengths. And then it's also important to do those strengths, to sort of bring forth goodness into the world. When we're using our strengths of fairness or kindness or forgiveness, we're doing more good into the world. When we're linking it in with our job tasks and our work, we're bringing forth our best parts of ourselves in our work. So much of this is about both being and doing. Being authentic, so being your strengths, being who you are, and also about doing, bringing forth more goodness to your relationships into the world.
Great advice. Ryan Nemec, thanks so much for joining us here on Career Buzz.
My pleasure, Mark. Thanks.
That was my interview with Dr. Ryan Nemec. Wasn't that great? He's really a wise guy. Up next, hey, if you are an expert at procrastination, as I am, why don't we hear from the best? This guy is the real deal. I so enjoyed meeting Dr. Tim Pitchell. He has earned an international reputation for his research on, wait for it, procrastination. He's director of the Center for Initiatives in Education and associate professor of psychology at Carleton University in Ottawa. Tim co-edited 2 books, the most recent of which is Procrastination, Health and Well-Being. He's also author of Solving the Procrastination Puzzle, a concise guide to strategies for change. Check him out on his Psychology Today blog, his I Procrastinate podcast, and at procrastination.ca. Here's my interview with Dr. Tim Pitchell. So what do you like about your career these days?
Well, being a professor, I think, is one of the best jobs in the world, because in terms of the research. I've got so much autonomy in terms of what I'm going to study and how, and it gives me a way to interact with students around doing research. And then on the teaching side of it, it's just so gratifying to work with young people as they're learning. So the university is just a wonderful career.
And what would you say are the top few skills or aptitudes that you use to be successful in your work?
There's a couple of ways that I have to think about my work. On the one hand, it's really, really public, so I can be doing large lectures or working with groups of people, and so I have to have interpersonal skills, strong listening skills, presentation skills. But at the same time, there's a part of my job that's not that extroverted self, but a terribly introverted self, where I have to be able to spend hours doing research with a concentrated focus and a real attention to detail. So it draws on lots of parts of who I am and some of my strengths and things I've had to strengthen over the years as well.
Right on. And, you know, everybody has a career story, and we've heard a lot of different career stories on this show, Career Buzz. What's one turning point that you can share with listeners in your journey that brought you to the present?
Well, you know, if you'd met me in the 70s, I'm a 62-year-old guy now, and that told me I was going to be a professor, I would have laughed in your face. You know, I was a good student, but I wasn't a committed student, and I really felt school was quite an unnatural act. And I was in and out of school. I dropped out of my undergraduate, went back and finished it. I started another's master's program and left it. I had a really circuitous route. I really did follow my passions constantly. My early career was teaching tennis, and that's a really important part of my story, but I'll come back to that. And then I was working in the outdoor industry, teaching canoeing, whitewater canoeing, selling canoes. And then I did a linguistics degree to teach English as a second language. And it was there in my late 20s that I thought, wow, when you focus a little bit, you really do well, Tim. And then I moved on to do a master's, did 2 or 3 years of a PhD, had a crisis of faith in psychology, an epistemological crisis. I wasn't sure about the knowledge claims I was making anymore, quit, worked in linguistics again. And then I did a Bachelor of Education because I thought, well, the common thread in my life going way back to those years teaching tennis is teaching. So I did a Bachelor of Education, got a job as a teacher, and then there was a big layoff going on. So I only had my job as a teacher for a year. So then I finished the PhD, and then I ended up as a professor. So you can see that was a very convoluted route to become a professor, but I'm very happy that I did.
Wow, that's a lot of pieces of the story, a lot of zigs and zags. It seems like there's always, you know, clues. It's not just happenstance, but there are clues, and even that story that you just told of being a teacher, and then, you know, the clue is, well, this doesn't look sustainable here. So it sounds like there was a mix of clues and then inspired actions. I know we're going to talk about procrastination in a few minutes, but it sounds like you were able to overcome that and use some volitional skills to push through some of these moments of uncertainty. What would you say that you drew on there to keep going in the face of all that uncertainty?
Well, it was I was willing to take risks and go after the things that interested me. So in all that story, you know, if I told you the intricacies of that story, I was fascinated with and loved canoeing, and so I got into that industry. But then one day I was driving back from teaching whitewater canoeing, and I was with another instructor, and I said, what are you up to next? And she said she was on her way to Nigeria to teach English as a second language. And I asked her, how did you get to do that? And she explained she got this certificate from Carleton. It was a year-long program, post-degree. I dropped her off, and I drove right to Carleton that day. So I was a person that harnessed my risk-taking abilities to really just try things that I had a passion or interest in, and I would follow that through. So I think the secret there was that I found things that I was passionate about, and then I was willing to invest myself in them. And there was a lot of uncertainty involved, and certainly economics setbacks at time. You know, being a student always cost me money. Getting a late start at being a professor was difficult. But at the same time, it was a great way to get there. And in fact, I would argue it was the only way I could get there. So, yeah, it was. I think in terms of volitional skills, I had my own struggles. You know, at the end of the journey, you can talk about it like you didn't have dark nights of the soul, but I did. I had lots of uncertainty at times and questioned myself. But on the way, I kept following that passion.
So, Tim, let's turn our attention to this really interesting topic of procrastination. I know you've been looking at it for quite some time, and trying to figure it all out and understand it from a research point of view as well. But it's such a common problem. Anybody has experienced it. You know, I know there's all kinds of interesting ways for us to look at it and comparing it to Homer Simpson, and we'll get there. But what's essentially the problem? You know, if you were trying to describe it and say the problem that procrastination is connected to, how would we describe that problem?
Well, I'd want to start by saying what it's not. Everyone thinks procrastination is a time management problem. Well, time management is necessary. It's not sufficient. And what procrastination is at heart is an emotion management problem. So you face a task that you find aversive for some reason. It's boring. It's frustrating. You resent doing it. It causes you anxiety. You pick your favorite negative emotion. We all have them. And they vary by task. But what we want to do is we want to get rid of that emotion. Basically, we're always looking to feel good. And so what we do is we give in to feel good. We say, well, I'm not doing that then. Our coping strategy is to avoid. And that's what we call procrastination. We use that avoidance to make us feel good now. That's the crux of the issue with procrastination. It's not that I don't know how to manage my time. In fact, I've scheduled it typically. I said, okay, I intend to do this. But when I get there, I say, I don't want to. I don't feel like it. So now how do I get past those feelings becomes the question.
Right. And it's almost like we have a wedge between our present self and our future self. You told a funny story about linking this story to Homer Simpson. So what's the connection to Homer Simpson?
Well, you know, even some of the most award-winning Nobel laureates in economics, Richard Taylor from the University of Chicago, argues that we're more like Homer Simpson than we are Homo economicus. We're not that rational. And the cartoon that I was showing in part of my talk had Marge, Homer's wife, saying to him, you know, homie, someday these kids are going to be grown and you're going to regret not spending more time with them. And Homer, in his infinite wisdom, says, yeah, that's a problem for future Homer. Man, I don't envy that guy. And Homer just gets it, right? That there's present self and there's future self, and we're willing to just give it to future self because present self wants to feel good now. But the great thing about Homer is that he shows us that, yeah, we all understand that we're involved in a real self-defeating behavior.
Yeah, and we trick ourselves, right? Like you say, it's an emotional problem, and there's this funny trick that we can play with ourselves called, I'll feel more like it tomorrow.
And yes, and we believe that, which is the crazy thing.
So let's, you know, in our short time together here, how do we move toward an understanding of this that helps us in our everyday situations, whether it's work or personal situations, to overcome it? And I was fascinated with one thing. I'd come across it before, but you were highlighting it again with this distinction between goal intentions. You know, we have these big goals that we set ourselves, and it's so hard to get started on these big goals. But now there's this other thing called implementation intentions. So what is that, and how can that help us overcome procrastination?
Sure. Well, you know, we all have goals. That's one of the things that makes us human. We're very goal-oriented. And we say, these are the things I'd like to accomplish, or these are my desires. But they're so broad as to have very little motivational value, and they don't hold our feet to the fire, so to speak. But an implementation intention is what it sounds like. It's how do we implement that? So in what situation am I going to do what behavior? So, for example, we decided yesterday that it would be best for us to do an interview today, and so we had to take some actions to do that, setting up our call, setting up the Skype equipment, and all that sort of thing. So in situation X, I'll do behavior Y. And so really, to get past procrastination, and we all need to, we can all find things in our lives that it's tempting to put off, even though we know it could bite us in the butt in the end. We just have to focus on the next action. And if we can link it to the environment like an implementation intention does, that in situation X, I'll do this behavior, something really simple and straightforward, something that I understand, now the cue for our action is in the environment, and that takes us out of our habits. So it helps us establish new habits, and that's very powerful. So, you know, this notion of an implementation intention is situation X, I'll do behavior Y, and I constantly, in my own life, will boil it down to, what's the next action, Tim? And that really gets me going, because most of us, the problem is just getting started.
Right on. So what's the next action? You know, and you flagged that for us in your talk. And I shared with you, we've been using this term, inspired action, just to try and get that little step started, which is, it's surprising that that people think like, oh, you know, I'll feel more like it tomorrow. Once they get into something, they actually don't mind it, or they don't think it's bad, as bad as they thought it was. But it's that one little step. So what happens if we take that one little step, even though, you know, we think that the goal is too big, but the one little step actually was easier, and if we follow that question, what's the next action? What's then likely to happen if I take that small step?
Well, I'd like to add something to that, and I'll answer that question directly. But, you know, something I didn't mention yesterday that really bears noting is that I don't know where we get this belief, but most adults and people believe that their motivation has to match the task at hand. And we think we have to feel like it, and we don't. And so what happens is when we make a little bit of progress on a goal that we don't feel like working on, what we see in research is that even a little bit of progress fuels our well-being, and that well-being fuels our motivation. And so some psychologists have called this an upward spiral of motivation and well-being. So it's really important to get these little wins. And so when we say, what's that next action, that inspired action, we keep it small enough that the threshold doesn't overwhelm us and that we can make that step. And then when we make that step, we see ourselves acting. It makes us feel better about ourselves, and we're making progress, which fuels our well-being. So it's really win-win, and it's very, very important, because we even know that those wins build self-efficacy, this feeling of confidence that I can do it. And that is the foundation for a very positive mindset, a growth mindset, as we might argue.
Wow, that was a great little way to summarize it all. Tim, I appreciate it. You know, I was interested in this little term that you threw out called volitional skill. So if we try and package up what you just said there, it's maybe a new term for listeners. You know, and there's a lot of things that kind of fit into it, but I think you're talking about this in a great way here. If we talk about volitional skill, it's something that might be unfamiliar with people. How would we define it? Is there any tips that you can share with listeners about increasing their own volitional skill?
Yes, volition isn't a word we typically use, although I have a colleague in Russia I'm working with where volition is a major focus. It's not an uncommon word, but basically it refers to will. So you could think about skills for will. How can I harness my willpower? Sometimes we really feel like it's flagging. And so volitional skills are those tiny little things that we can do that help us out. At one point yesterday, I talked about outsourcing our willpower. That could be a volitional skill. So for example, say I want to exercise more. Or, yeah, well, I'll keep that as the example, although it's not necessarily work-related. It is something that is important to all of our lives. And I find that, you know, I could let myself off the hook. Oh, I'm too tired. I don't want to go. But I know that I'd never let another person down. So you and I, Mark, decide I'm going to go exercise with you. And so now, even though I don't feel like it, I wouldn't let you down, and I show up. So I've used what some psychologists call ecological affordances. I use my environment around me. I set it up in such a way that it harnesses me in a positive way. And that's a volitional skill, to be able to look around the world and find, how can I arrange things that it makes it easier for me to do the things that I know I want to do, my goals, and harder for me to do the things that are so habitual that are really getting me into a dead end. But there's many volitional skills. I often joke with my students that one of the key volitional skills is keeping the seat of your pants on the seat of your chair long enough for you to get past some of those emotions that make you want to run away. And that's really crucial. And sometimes that volitional skill might even be just some deep breathing. You know, most of us, if we've ever attended a workshop where we learn about relaxation, you take 3 or 4 deep breaths, just in through your nose and out through your mouth. Your body starts to change, and some of those emotions that were causing you to panic and want to run away go away. So even that you can consider as a really basic volitional skill, to strategically use breathing to relax and get yourself centered again. So those are examples, but there are so many things that count as volitional skills. These are the things that we learn that are strategies for us to make us more effective.
Last question, Tim Pitchell. Based on all the personal experiences you've had and the zigzags in your career that you shared earlier in the interview, what's one thing you can share with listeners about making good choices, you know, making career and life choices? People face these moments all the time. From your own experience, what's one thing you can share?
Well, I think you have to, and we heard this a lot in the conference yesterday, we have to keep in mind that life has an ending point. And this is not to be morose, but to accept the existential reality of, this is my life. You know, what is it I want to do with my life? As I was telling you my own personal story, I think one of the things that was very positive about me, because we have strengths and we have weaknesses, is that I always kind of embraced the idea that, well, this is not a dress rehearsal. Do you want to try this? You're going to step up and give it a go. And so I think you have to keep that in mind. And so it's not a matter of, I'll do it tomorrow, because tomorrow may not be there, right? That will be a reality sometime that we don't think about so much. So the question always becomes, or the focus I have is, this is my life, what am I going to make of it? And I think when we do that, it changes our attitude towards decision-making and action.
Great, great advice, Tim. If people want to find out more about your work and research, how do they do that?
Well, if you go to procrastination.ca, you'll see that when you get to the homepage, you'll see the kind of things I'm publishing with my students, but you'll also find links to a blog that I've been writing for Psychology Today and my own I Procrastinate podcast, where I talk to other researchers about these things. And in there, of course, we tell stories about procrastination that's helpful to people who aren't interested in research.
Right on. Tim Pitchell, thanks so much for joining us here on Career Buzz.
Wasn't that a great interview with Tim Pitchell? So many great ideas from research to practice about overcoming procrastination. Simply put, what's the next action? What's the next action to get that thing done? And one thing leads to another, and suddenly it snowballs into an upward spiral of motivation and well-being. Thanks so much, Tim Pitchell. That was awesome. Next up, Margarita Tarragona from Mexico. She's a psychologist who specializes in applying positive psychology in the helping professions and education. She co-founded and teaches in Grupo Campos Elíseos in Mexico City. She's adjunct faculty on the Whole Being Institute and teaches in the Certificate in Positive Psychology Latin America. Margarita incorporates scientific findings on well-being and collaborative and narrative ways of working with people to generate dialogue and expand their life stories. She's author of Positive Identities, Positive Psychology and Narrative Practices. Here's my interview with Margarita Tarragona.
So what do you like about your career these days?
Oh, I love my work. I feel really lucky because I think almost every day after I go to work, I feel fulfilled and stimulated and lucky. I really like my work. What I like the most, I think, as a coach and as a therapist, is the opportunity to have close relationships with people. I feel people really open up their lives to me and their hearts, and that's, I know it sounds corny, but I really feel it's almost sacred. You know, it's to have that kind of connection with people, I think, is an incredible privilege.
Nice. And I know you do a number of different things. You work right with clients directly, and then you also teach. What are all the things that make up your career?
Most of my life, my career has had two clear sections. One is the one-on-one work with people in therapy, also with couples, with families, but therapy and coaching. And the other is training. For a long time, I've trained therapists, and for the past 15 years or so, I've also trained a lot of people in positive psychology. So those are the two, let's say, the two legs of my career, the training, teaching, and the one-on-one work.
What are the strengths or skills that you use to do that, to both work with individual clients and to train? What would you say are the top few skills that you use to be successful?
Well, one is love of learning. I really like to learn, like most people in, you know, in academia. So one is love of learning. I like to stay updated, to learn about positive psychology, the science of happiness and well-being. And I like to share that. And then another strength, the one that is more apparent in my work as a therapist and coach, I think, is what would you call it? Social intelligence or empathy or interpersonal. The interest and curiosity about other people and caring for other people.
Nice. So many people in positive psychology came to it from different areas, and there's lots of twists and turns in the career stories of people in this field. What's one turning point that you can share with listeners about your own career story?
Well, I was very lucky to be involved in positive psychology even before it had a name, because I did my doctoral studies at the University of Chicago, where Mihai Csikszentmihalyi, one of the founders of positive psychology, was my professor. So I loved it, but at the time it was research, only research. And I wanted to be a therapist, so I later got training as a therapist. And for many years, positive psychology was like in the back of my mind, but my everyday work was therapy. And I had the chance, more of 15 years ago approximately, to start a training program in positive, to create a diploma program in positive psychology, the first in the world in Spanish at the University Iberoamericana in Mexico City. And then is when I started to really integrate what had become an interest of mine that I didn't see as very applicable to my work as a therapist, started to become more and more relevant. And now I would say that my specialty is to integrate positive psychology into therapy and coaching in a very practical, applicable way. And the reason why it was a career, a turning point for me is that because I also had the opportunity to teach people and to be involved in the diffusion of positive psychology in the Spanish-speaking world, and I've been lucky to kind of be one of the leaders in that world, and that has made me very feel very fortunate and very fulfilled in what I do.
Nice. Margarita, let's talk a little bit about this interesting overlap between positive psychology and storytelling or narrative practices. And mm-hmm. I know you weave this kind of storytelling and narrative approach into your work in positive psychology. What is the connection?
I think there's a lot of connections. In what we call narrative practice, which is working with people to help them enlarge their stories or enrich their stories about their lives. Sometimes people have what we call a dominant story, which is a way of thinking about themselves, of talking about themselves that is restrictive or oppressive and doesn't give them enough room to be closer to how they prefer to be. And so when we work this way, we pay a lot of attention to exceptions or to things that contradict the dominant story. For example, if somebody says, well, I'm a failure, I'm a good for nothing, nothing that I do goes well, we explore when things have gone well, what things has he or she done that really make him feel proud, what other people appreciate. So that expands the story. And it fits with positive psychology because, as you know, positive psychology is interested in studying what works well in people's lives, what is good in our existence, what are our strengths, what are the values that guide us. So I see that there's a lot of overlap because the things that positive psychology studies are the things that constitute the best stories about ourselves and about our lives.
It's interesting about the best stories. I've also noticed, because we use narrative in our career coaching practice.
I know, it's great, by the way.
Sometimes the best stories are wonderful to listen to, but we also can learn so much about the problematic
Absolutely.
Stories. And not to dwell on problems, no, but sometimes there's great clarity that comes from things that you didn't
agree.
Like.
I agree.
So give us an example of the flip side, where something that might be a negative story, maybe listeners are experiencing some of their own negative stories,
right.
And what can we learn and how can we use our both sides of the coin, both sides of the stories?
I totally agree. When I mentor best stories, I'm glad you mentioned it. I don't mean the ones that are necessarily the most joyful, the ones that are most meaningful. I think that one of the characteristics of stories is that they are charged with meaning, and that's what makes them important in our lives. And you're right, sometimes the most painful things are the most meaningful ones. I recently had a client in therapy who came to see me because of marital conflict, but she had suffered from a very serious life-threatening disease. And to my surprise, she told me she wouldn't change that for anything, because it totally changed her way of looking at life, at herself. She realized how strong she is. She really connected with a spirituality that feels grounds her beyond any circumstance. So I was surprised, because I have read about this, but rarely had I seen somebody spontaneously tell me that out of so much pain came so much growth. Mm.
We sometimes have heard that on other Career Buzz interviews, where people have had a health scare, mm-hmm. something seriously impacting their health, and how that changes their perspective, both on personal relationships and at work. So can I ask you to think a little bit about workplace situations, maybe clients that you've heard about workplace challenges or problems, and how can we apply, not just health scares, but how can we apply this idea of the overlap between narrative and positive psychology to people who might be having challenges or problems in the world of work?
I think it's very applicable, and it depends on how uncomfortable or difficult their situation is. One thing that can be done if somebody is unhappy at work is what is called job crafting, which is to look at the different activities that you do in your work and see which ones you enjoy and which ones you don't, and as much as possible to do more of what you like and try not to do a lot of what you don't like. Also to know your strengths, and if you're lucky to have a supervisor or boss who knows your strengths, that has been shown to be one of the best predictors of happiness at work. So if you can do things to use your strengths at work, that's great. If you're definitely unhappy and you're gonna cannot take it anymore and you've decided to leave, a lot of people realize that as hard as and as scary as that is, sometimes it gives them a lot of clarity to know what you definitely are not good at, what you definitely don't like. If you take that information seriously, you can take an informed next step in your next career opportunity if you have that choice.
Nice. Let's just take one step up from working directly with clients, whether it's workplace or relationships, and thinking about helping the helpers.
Yes.
So in a workplace, managers are often kind of coaches for their employees.
That's true.
And I know you've also worked with others who are learning the skills of coaching so that they in turn can help others. So if listeners are trying to figure out, like, hey, I want to be a kind of a coach. Even if I'm a manager, I want to be more of a coach manager than a traditional manager.
Mm-hmm.
How can people infuse positive psychology into their repertoire, whether they're a manager or a coach or a counselor or anybody who's listening?
One thing that we've mentioned, I think, is for many the jewel of the crown of positive psychology is strengths. To be aware that we all have strengths. We all have things that when we do them, we feel energized, that we do well, that interest us, and we also have character strengths, which are the bright side of our personality, things like being generous, curious, fair. So to have a radar for people's strengths is a very powerful thing. And to put it into words, not just to say good job, but say, I'm really glad to see how you persevered, or I thought that's a creative solution, to actually use a strength vocabulary. Another one is to encourage a positive emotional environment at work. For example, to start meetings asking people for a short round in which they say something funny that has happened to them lately or something that they're proud of that their team has achieved. That sets a positive tone. To encourage gratitude in the workplace is also a very useful thing to do. To have either a gratitude board where once a week people write something they're grateful for, or a gratitude jar where people may put a little paper with something they're grateful for that week. Those are little things, but they really have an impact on the way people feel at work.
Beautiful. Nice suggestions. Thanks so much for that. We're here at the Canadian Positive Psychology Association conference, and I was impressed at the end of your session, you actually showed this gorgeous slide of a garden.
Mm-hmm.
And I know you use plants and gardens as a metaphor. What can we learn from, you know, the beauty of the outdoors and gardens and plants that might metaphorically help us?
Oh, well, I hadn't thought about it, but now that you mention, I think that there's uniqueness and beauty in every single plant, and they're all different. And that's part of what makes a garden beautiful. And we are all different. We all have different strengths, different talents. And if we allow that to flourish instead of trying to change into what we're not. And things also take their different times. Some things are faster to grow than others. So I think it's a combination of having the right soil, which I think would have to do with love and acceptance and appreciation, and appreciating how things grow at a different rate and they have different fruits.
Beautiful. I love that metaphor connection. Last question, Margarita. You know, back to the personal, you told us a little bit about your own career story and some twists and turns. What's one thing that you can share with listeners about something you've learned about making good choices, good career choices, good life choices? What's one thing you can share with listeners about what you've learned?
One thing I've learned is that you never know what one learning or one job will bring into your life later on. For there's many things that I didn't think might be directly relevant that have now become the center of my work. So I think that everything you learn can be useful, and that we all end up making our own combination of experiences that make us unique.
Great advice, Margarita. Thanks so much for joining us here. If people want to find out more about you and your practice and your podcast, how do they do that?
Thank you. My podcast is in Spanish, but if there are any Spanish-speaking people there, I would love you to become listeners. You can find my website, which is www.positivamente.com.mx, and that is positivamente, positivamente.com.mx.
Margarita Tarragona, muchas gracias.
Gracias a ti.
Thank you for joining us on Career Buzz.
My pleasure. Thank you.
Thank you for listening to the Career Buzz podcast. Find us on iTunes or visit careercycles.com/radio to subscribe and download past episodes. Get inspiring career stories full of twists and turns, actionable ideas from career experts, and new ideas to empower your own career in life.